One thing I would like to say as we begin, it's easy to get comfortable and just talk with each other, but we've got people online that need to hear. So everybody speak up when you speak, and off we go. Isaiah 33. Maybe you got my text, my email today, maybe you didn't, but did you notice how I connected Isaiah 33 with Isaiah 10 and Isaiah 36? We'll see it as we progress. But first of all, I want to back up and say, who are the two major, other than Israel, because Israel's kind of the center of discussion, who are the two major names that we're concerned about in the early books of early chapters of Isaiah? Assyria, not yet.
Egypt.
Egypt,
Egypt.
Assyria and Egypt. Assyria represented the threat. Egypt represented what?
Well,
Louder.
we're going to lose.
Yeah, the false hope. Let's say it that way. Yeah, Egypt represented the lean on other than God, the false hope. And we've addressed that, how that the covenant that you've made with death will not stand. You're talking about the pact that they made with Egypt. We saw the animals that were traipsing across the Negev to go to Egypt with all the precious loot. What do you call it when you're hiring an ally?
Mercenary.
No, that's tribute. Yeah. Something of that nature. Okay, so we've seen all of that, and I want to remind you that as we're dealing with here, Israel can't see the future, can't see even maybe the hint that Babylon is on their radar, but that's 100 years away. Can't see the Medo-Persian, certainly can't see the Alexandrian or the Roman aggression against the Jews. All they can see, the embodiment of foreign aggression, is Assyria. And so oftentimes Assyria will be put as the threat, and the removal of Assyria will be God dealing with the threat to set Israel free. From their perspective, they can't see what we can see looking back. All they can see is Assyria, let's get Egypt to help us. All right. And so what we saw last week, we're going to see it really in a mass m mashed up mingle. Wow, what the alliteration going on there? The mash, max, mash. Anyway, whatever I said, of future and current, future and current, future and current. To we've gone back and forth, back and forth. A king will reign in righteousness, but right now we got ignoble people in control. So we got the current being addressed and the future being addressed. We're really going to see that all combined together, as I said, in chapter 33. What else do I want to point out? Yeah, go ahead.
Is it Judah and Israel going to Egypt for help, or?
It's mainly Judah. Israel's about to be taken out of the picture shortly. They haven't been taken out of the picture yet. So Isaiah is addressing the whole group, because it's the whole group that's going to be brought back, at least the ones that are willing to be brought back, of all 12 tribes, not just of the two that were there in Judah. Yeah.
Well, a remnant of the 10 tribes escaped Assyria and went to Judah, right?
Some did. Some. What's that word that you find at the beginning of Peter and James? The diaspora,
Diaspora, yeah.
the dispersion. Some of the Jews were dispersed into foreign countries, and were actually, by the time of Jesus, they were looked upon as almost as bad as the Gentiles, because they're living out there among the Gentiles. He won't go to the Gentiles, will he? They said of Jesus. And they weren't talking about just hardened Gentiles. They were talking about the Jews that lived among the Gentiles as well, like Timothy, for example, a Jew that lived among the Gentiles. And so those were the diaspora, the dispersed ones. Okay, we're going to see some of that here. tonight as well. There was something else. Yeah, in chapter 32, where we covered last week, it starts off, "Behold, a king will reign righteously." Well, now Isaiah is looking at the future. But look down here in verse 9. Rise up, you women who are at ease, and hear my voice. Give ear to my word, you complacent daughters. Within a year or days, you will be troubled. What's that talking about?
A year.
That's the current situation, present. So in verse 1, he's talking about the future hope. But in verse 9, he's back to the current situation. And then when we get into verse 14, because the palace has been abandoned, the populated city forsaken, we saw in chapter 24 at verse 20 that when Jerusalem fell, it would not rise again. Not that Jerusalem would cease to be a city, but it would cease to be God's city, which is what we saw in Galatians 4. The Jerusalem from above is our mother. The Jerusalem that now is in bondage with her children. Paul saw the current Jerusalem as just enslaved to their hardness of heart and sin, and that there would be this new Jerusalem. So the populated city forsaken here in verse 14, hill and watchtower have become caves forever. He's looking at future desolation of Jerusalem, even though it would be desolated within 100 years. It would be repopulated as God's city when they came back from the Babylonian exile. Jeremiah said it would be 70 years, and when they'd return, Daniel saw the 70 years, prayed about it, and they returned back to Jerusalem, which was, according to Daniel, rebuilt in a time of trouble, but then it would be destroyed, and a complete destruction. You look at the last four verses of Daniel 9, and you'll see Daniel seeing that, and of course, it just caused him to be heartsick, thinking that this city that I'm praying about going to be rebuilt and then just totally devastated. But God had a better city than a physical city. And so that's what he's talking about here in verse 14. But look at verse 15. See, this city, the palace is abandoned, the populated city forsaken. It was just a place for donkeys to run until what?
Spirit.
Until the Spirit is poured out from on high. And then the wilderness becomes a fertile field, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It looks like the pouring out of the Spirit is tantamount to, let me say it this way before I go there. You know, the project that was years ago that involved the various dams along the Columbia River. Have you ever flown over that area and you see these huge green circles? What is that?
Irrigation
has turned the wilderness into a what? Into a garden with the irrigation. The pouring out of the Spirit is we'll see this going through Isaiah. The pouring out of the Spirit is God's way of saying, I'm going to water the hearts of my people, and they will produce the fruit of the Spirit. But here, all he can do is say it in terms and language that they could wrap their minds around, that the wilderness will become a fertile field, and the fertile field is a force. And watch this, verse 16, justice and righteousness. You remember back in chapter 5, the branch of God's planting was a selected vine, and he put it in a very special place. And he provided wine press, and he provided guard tower and all of this for his vineyard. And when he came looking for grapes, what did he find? Bad or worthless ones. Okay. But the text goes on in explanation of the parable. What was God looking for? Justice and righteousness. That's the good grapes. But what he found is murder and bloodshed instead. All right. Now, when he pours the Spirit out, there will be justice and righteousness. All right. Verse 18, then my people will live in a peaceful habitation. We could go all the way back to chapter 2, where in the last days, when the mountain of the house of the Lord will be raised up as the chief among the mountains, and the law of God would go forth, they would do what with their swords and plowshares? Do what with their swords and spears? Beat them into plowshares so that they could have an agrarian society. What do you read here? An agrarian society where my people are at peace. It's stated differently, but it's the same point. That when God finishes what he's doing, right now they're on the beginning edge of it. The beginning edge of the national darkness was going off into Assyrian captivity. But coming out the other side, when he poured out the Spirit, there would be this fruitfulness, this taking of dried up dead hearts and causing them to flourish and blossom and bloom and bear fruit. Okay, that's what we covered last week and the week before. Now, I want to turn our attention to the destroyer. Woe to you, O destroyer. 33:1. Woe to you, O destroyer, while you were not destroyed. Now, I know if you're looking at the headings, you might see that it's talking about
Assyria.
Probably. That's probably what they had in my outline for myself. I said, Assyria arise. Yahweh arises against Assyria, the destroyer. That Assyria is the destroyer. You remember back in chapter 10? In chapter 10, what was the picture that we saw? Assyria as the axe in God's hand, right? Assyria was an axe. And what do you do with an axe? You cut down the forest. Assyria was being used by God. In verse 6, I send it. See, verse 5, woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger. That's chapter 10, verse 5. Verse 6, I send it against a godless nation. He's going out to cut down a godless nation. That's a question. Israel. Send it against Israel. Going to cut down Israel, or he says in verse 10, Jerusalem and Samaria. So the combined, the 12 tribes combined. I'm going to cut them down. Assyria is the axe in my hand. But verse 7, it doesn't so intend. 6 says, I send it. But verse 7 says, that wasn't his intent. I'm not just out here obeying God. My intent is just go out and plunder. Ravage and pillage and murder and rape and plunder. That's my intent. God's intent was to cut down his godless people. Now, you might remember, look over here, where it says in verse 24, therefore, thus says the Lord Yahweh of hosts, O my people who dwell in Zion, don't fear the Assyrian who strikes you with the rod and lifts up his staff against you the way Egypt did. For in a very little while, my indignation against you will be spent. What does that tell you? The coming, the allowing of Assyria to invade Israel and Judah was God's indignation. Now, Daniel is really big on talking about the period of indignation, but that's beyond our scope right here, okay? And so my indignation against you will be spent, verse 25, and my anger will be to their destruction. And Yahweh of hosts will arouse a scourge against him, like the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Or. 10:24-26. Okay, so the destroyer was Assyria. Chapter 33 is God talking to him. When you get to 36, 7, 8, and 9, I've often wondered, why is Isaiah just inserting the chapters from 2 Kings into his book? And the answer came to me this time through Isaiah. He's sticking them in there to show that he kept his promise to destroy Assyria on behalf of Jerusalem. See, in 10, he promised it. Here in 34, he's addressing Assyria himself of woe to you, O destroyer, while you are not destroyed. and he who is treacherous while others did not deal treacherously with him. As soon as you finish destroying, you will be destroyed. Isn't that what God promised in chapter 10? As soon as you shall cease to deal treacherously, others will deal treacherously with you. That's what Babylon did to Assyria. All right. Oh, and okay, so there is, that's the situation about Assyria. But look at verse 2. Oh, Yahweh, be gracious to us. And I just told you I'm going to destroy you. Yet, how long is it going to be until the reprieve comes? Remember, earlier in the book, we saw morning comes, but also night. Morning comes, wave after wave of opposition that would come until Israel was finally, or Judah was finally, taken out of the national darkness when a light would shine in the darkness. Remember that? Chapter 9, though people sitting in darkness saw a great light. Matthew 4, that happened to fulfill Isaiah when Jesus started preaching. So there was this long period of national darkness. And so, oh, Yahweh, be gracious to us. They're right at the onset of what turns out to be, I mean, if it's 700 BC when it starts, and it's 30 AD when it ends, how long is this? We have waited for you. Okay, now, Alan, you can't wait longer than your lifetime, but you can wait expectantly and full of hope and confidence that this is what God is going to do, even though you don't see it. You remember what Jesus said about Abraham and John? Abraham longed to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. Or in Hebrews 11, Abraham was looking for a city. On the horizon, there was a city that Abraham was looking for and would not be satisfied with any substitute along the way. People can do that even though they don't realize the fulfillment of the promise. They can base their lives upon the expectation of fulfillment of the promise. And that's a really, really important thought. And so it says here, O Yahweh, be gracious to us, for we have waited for you. Now, can you think of places in the book of Isaiah where we saw this idea of waiting? For example, in chapter 8, where he says, just after he described the flood that was Assyria coming into the nation, he said in verse 16, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. Bind it up and seal it. It's kind of like put it in safekeeping, or hold it tight in your heart. And I will wait for Yahweh, who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will even look eagerly for him. Behold, I and the children whom Yahweh has given me are signs and wonders in Israel. Remember the two boys that God gave Isaiah? Shear Jashub, Mahershalal Hashbaz. Okay. Means what? What? Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey, and a remnant shall return. The two names. Okay? Got to wait for that. The prey is coming quickly. A remnant will return. My two sons, Isaiah says, are indicative of that. But we have to, verse 17, 8, 17, wait. I will wait for him. Now look also at chapter 26. Now, chapter 26 is part of what 24, 5, 6, and 7 is also known as what?
Pardon? Little apocalypse.
A little apocalypse, Isaiah's apocalypse. Things looking at the final pouring out of the curse where a few men are left. That's 24, verse 6. But here in 26, he says, come, my people. Chapter 26, verse 20. Enter your rooms, close your doors behind you, hide for a little while until the indignation runs its course. Okay, so here in chapter 33, O Yahweh, be gracious to us, for we have waited for you. It's like It's like the current generation is putting the words in the mouth of the future generation. We have waited. We're the ones that have been patiently waiting, faithfully waiting. Why was there somebody as useful to God as a gal named, a young teenager named Mary, and a man named Joseph, and a man named Zechariah, and a woman named Elizabeth? Why were there people like that at the time that was so corrupt that God had to destroy that people? Why were there people like that? Because they were waiting patiently for God to act. They had that faith that God is going to do this. Is just like Joseph made command concerning his bones that when we leave Egypt, take my bones with you. That's in Hebrews 11. So there are people who can so trust that what God said he's going to do, that they can build their life on that faith, even though they don't see it. I know I made that point a minute ago, but that's what's going on here. Okay. 26:20, wait, close your door, hide until the indignation runs his course, for behold, Yahweh is about to come out of his place. He's going to come and he's going to whoop up. And there's going to be a lot of turmoil. There's going to be a lot of pressure. You're going to feel the pressure that comes by being invaded from a foreign army. Wait for me to finish that. You're going to go through the privations of being hauled off into captivity. Wait for me. Say, hide yourself and wait for me to finish what I'm doing. Don't just give up because I started doing it. Wait until I finish doing it. And so coming back here to chapter 33, be gracious to us, for we have waited for you. Be their strength every morning, our salvation also in the time of distress. So you're hearing here the yearning of a people that are on the leading edge going into that great period of indignation against Israel. God's indignation against Israel. God's refining of the remnant that would follow Jesus when he came. At the sound of the tumult. What's a tumult? You say something is tumultuous. Craziness?
Bottom of the water.
The people, okay? But this tumult would be the rousing up of the armies that God would use, and the battle, the noise and the disruption of battle. At the lifting up of yourself, nations disperse, and your spoil is gathered as a caterpillar gathers. I see here what Isaiah is describing of when we wait and God finally arouses himself, there's going to be this. There's going to be a people. There's going to be nations dispersing. There's going to be spoil. It's like locusts rushing about. Men rush on it. What does that remind you of? Locusts rushing about, men rush on it. Pardon?
The locusts in Revelation.
Locusts in Revelation is good. What else?
Joel.
Save Joel. And the plague in Egypt. But Joel uses locust as a precursor and a warning of the invasion of the Assyrian. Joel 1 is the locust invasion. Joel 2 is the Assyrian invasion. And Joel, end of Joel 2, says after, in the last days, there will be a final indignation against his people. The one that Peter warned him to escape in Acts 2. Okay, that's Joel to Acts 2 connected, but there's that locust invasion, which was the army of men just stripping the cities bare of anything, just like a locust would strip a tree bare. Okay, Yahweh, verse 5, Yahweh is exalted, he dwells on high, he has filled Zion with justice and righteousness. So here again, we're looking at the future. See, when he acts, we have waited for you. Well, this is what it's going to be. I'm going to fill Jerusalem with justice. Zion. I'm going to fill Zion with justice and righteousness. And he shall be the stability of your times, a wealth of salvation, wisdom, and knowledge. The fear of Yahweh is his treasure. Scott, I just kind of glommed onto that. The fear of Yahweh is his treasure. I don't know if the his there is Yahweh's treasure that I give to you, or the one who waits for Yahweh. I have this fear of Yahweh as a treasure. Does it make any difference?
Zion treasure, but then it also says he is
Well,
the footnote.
yeah, see, Zion is up in verse 5, but verse 6 doesn't have Zion in it. Somebody has added that. Okay. The fear of Yahweh is his singular treasure. It's either Yahweh's treasure that he's willing to share with you, or the man who has waited for Yahweh, the fear of him is his treasure. What does that mean to you? To think that the fear of Yahweh is your treasure. Can you think of anything more valuable in your life than your deep attachment to and respect for Yahweh? Is anything going to be position you better in life to make good choices, for example? He says, didn't he say, wisdom and knowledge? Think of Colossians 2, verse 3. In Jesus Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. That's that. Pardon?
Well, fear is the beginning of that.
Yeah, and Solomon said the fear of Yahweh is the beginning of wisdom. But here's the thing. When I act, now I've got Assyria coming in right now, and wave after wave after wave, all that we've gone through before. But when I finally act, you're going to have a respect for me that will be your treasure, will be the benefit of your life. Respect for me, your treasure, wisdom, and knowledge. That's not just, well, I know the plan of God. I know that working of God. It's, what is wisdom? How would you describe wisdom? Pardon? Well, that might be the source of wisdom. No, that's good. Knowledge applied. Seeing the end from the beginning, because you have experience and understanding. But there's more than that.
Seeing how the way I act today is going to affect me tomorrow.
That's it right there. Seeing how my choices today, based upon what I know and understand, well, the outcome of it down the road. I call wisdom outcome-based decision-making. Being able to make the decisions that will get me to the goal or avoid the disaster. And so that's his treasure. Verse 7, behold, their brave men cry in the streets, the ambassadors of peace weep bitterly. The brave men are crying and the ambassadors of peace are weeping. Who's he talking about? What's he talking about?
Is this Israel?
I think this is Israel during the Assyrian invasion or the Babylonian invasion or the Medo-Persian, you know. I think this is, you guys can't figure it out, haven't figured it out. When I do this for you, you'll have wisdom and understanding and a respect for me.
Yeah, it was their ambassadors that went to Assyria and asked for help.
It was their ambassadors who went to Egypt and asked for help.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They went to Assyria to ask for help against Syria and Israel. And that just brought Assyria in. So they went to Egypt to ask for help against Assyria. And they're weeping and crying because they have been useless. The highways are desolate. What does that mean economically if the highways are desolate? The trade droughts have been cut off by Assyria. Are we taking a commercial break here? The traveler has ceased. He has broken the covenant. He has despised the cities. He has no regard for man. I see this as the clampdown of Assyria on normal life in Israel. That's what he's describing. Would that be the same when Nebuchadnezzar was in power? And could easily be the same once Rome got in power. Rome ruled with an iron fist. There's a reason the picture in Daniel has iron and clay as a depiction of Rome. And there's a reason that in Daniel, the Roman, the beast that represents Rome was diverse and just couldn't be described. It was so gross or grotesque. But that, I think that's what he's talking about here, 7, 8, and 9, is the impact on Israel and Judah of the clampdown of these invading forces that God was bringing for the purpose of discipline, wait for me until it's finished type of approach. The land mourns, verse 9, and pines away. Lebanon is shamed and withers. What was Lebanon? What is famous? What was cedars, the famous cedars out of which Solomon built his temple, his palace, and his own home? Cedars of Lebanon, they pine, shamed and withered. Sharon is like a desert plain. Well, that was the coastal plain, which is very fruitful. It's like a desert plain. Bashan and Carmel lose foliage. Now, I don't know if he's being figurative, I think he is, or if he's being literal, and he could be. Because what would an invading army do with a walled city? Siege works. Where did the siege work come from? Surrounding forests. And so Lebanon's cut down. It might be. You certainly aren't going to have access to the fruitful plains of Sharon or Sharon. But then verse 10, now I will arise, says Yahweh. Now I will be exalted. Now I will be lifted up. You have conceived chaff. You will give birth to stubble. Now, I don't know if he's talking to Sennacherib, the current king of Assyria, whom we'll see again in chapter 36. Or if he's talking to the leaders of Israel who thought that they could get help when they went down to Egypt. You have conceived chaff, you give birth to stubble. My breath will consume you like fire. I think we saw some of that last week, didn't we? Our God is a consuming fire. Okay.
That's Lord God.
Verse 12 says the peoples.
The peoples will be burned to lime.
Yeah.
The peoples will be burned to lime like cut thorns which are burned in fire.
You might want to explain that, what I just said.
The peoples? What's the opposite? What is the counterpart to the peoples?
People.
The people. Who are the people? Israel. So the peoples are the Goyim. The Goyim was the Hebrew word. What's the Greek word?
Gentile.
Ethnos, the nations. And so it's translated in our Bible, Gentiles. But it means the nations, plural, rather than the nation, the nations. Okay? And so that's anybody that came against Israel, we've seen that also. Anybody that was opposed, whether it's Babylon or Assyria or Babylon or Medo-Persia or Rome, anybody that was opposed to Israel, God's breath will consume you like a fire. How does that make you feel? God's breath will consume your enemies like fire. You feel safe? What? Me worry? Yeah. Alfred? You're a new man. E, new man. Alfred, E, new man. Okay. You who are far away, hear what I've done. You who are near, acknowledge my might. Who are the far away and the near? Now, it could be just nations as a whole. And Isaiah is certainly broad enough and universal enough to regard nations as a whole. When we get over to, 45, I think it is, maybe it's 46. I've called you, Cyrus, but it's 45. I've called you by name that the world might know from the rising of the sun to its setting that there's no one like me. Now, what do you have from the rising to the setting of the sun? In their concept, it would be just the entire Assyrian Empire. But in my concept, what happens from the rising of the sun to its setting? That's world inclusive, isn't it? So, but then there's also this passage in Acts 2, where Peter in verse 38, I mean, that's a very, very, very famous verse, Acts 2:38. when the Jews there on the day of Pentecost, Jews from every nation in the Roman Empire were gathered, devout Jews from all nations. There were what, 17 different languages? Wasn't that what it was there in chapter 2? And he said, we all hear them speaking the marvelous works of God in our own language to which we were born. What does this mean? Ah, they're just drunk. Peter said, can't be drunk, it's too early. What this means is Joel is being fulfilled. Where Joel said, I'll pour out my spirit in the last days. And I'll whoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be delivered. And then there will be the great and awesome day of the Lord, which is always judgment. I'm about to burn this people up. If you call on me, I'll rescue you from it. And so in Acts 2, verse 39, see verse 38, whoever calls upon the name of the Lord, no. Repent and let each of you. Joel said, whoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. They said, what do we do? Peter told them. They knew they needed to call the name of the Lord, right? He said, repent, be baptized. Every one of you in the name of Jesus Christ, have your sins washed away. For the promise is for you and for your children and all those who are far off, as many as the Lord our God shall call to himself. And what did he go on to say? That was verse 39. What does verse 4 he say? And verse 40, Acts 2:40, and many and with many other words he solemnly testified and kept on exhorting, saying, be saved from this perverse generation. And Moses in Deuteronomy 32 said that the perverse generation was the one where God would avenge himself on his enemies. The enemies were his own people. And so those who were far away and those who were near. Well, those who were near were listening to him. Who were those who were far away? I think Peter is specifically referring to the dispersion. The Jews that had been scattered. God was, first of all, concerned about bringing the Jews back to himself, whoever would. That's why Paul was so urgent and diligent in his missionary journeys. There are people out here who need to hear and make a decision before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And it came in his generation, didn't it? God totally and finally destroyed the city of Jerusalem. Either Paul was still alive or had just died. And that was God's great wrath against that people. The far away and the near would be those living proximate and those Jews out among the Gentiles. Now, I know when we get over to chapter 46, I think it's 46, might be 49, verse 6, it's too small a thing that I raise you up to be a light, it's too small a thing that I make you my servant to raise up the fallen house of Israel and Judah. I will also make you a light to the Gentiles. And so God was concerned about the Gentiles, but I think the far away would refer to the scattered Jews. Either way. Verse 14, sinners in Zion are terrified. Trembling has seized the godless. Who among us can live with the consuming fire? Now, what was the consuming fire? Pardon? Yeah, but
God's judgment?
Wasn't it Assyria? Wasn't that who they were concerned about? I mean, you and I look back and we see wave after wave. What did they see? The tidal wave called Assyria. Who can endure this? Well, we saw up in verse 2, it says, we've waited for you. And so who among us can live in this consuming fire? Who among us can live with this continual burning? And then he answers it. What's this answer? And as I read this answer, I want you to think of a psalm of David that sounds a whole lot like this. He who walks righteously and speaks with sincerity, he who rejects unjust gain. Now, think with me back to chapter 5. I came looking for good grapes. I found worthless grapes. I came looking for justice and righteousness. I found murder and bloodshed, and then a series of woes Remember, the most of chapter 5 was a series of woes. Woe to you who do this. Woe to you who do that. Here we see the opposite of those woes. He who rejects unjust gain, shakes his hand so that they hold no bribe. He who stops his ear from hearing about bloodshed, shuts his eyes from looking upon evil. He will dwell on the heights. See, yeah, we're not talking about removing the burning fire, the consuming fire. So, Father, can I make it through this? All you need to do is be this kind of person. He will dwell on the heights. His refuge will be the impregnable rock. His bread will be given. His water will be sure. I'll make sure you have what you need in the fire. Now, Daniel hasn't come yet, and the Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego haven't come yet. Neither have Hananiah, Azariah, or Mishael. Know the Hebrew names of the Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. They haven't come yet. What did they, those three guys, what did they go through? The fire! And who appeared in the fire with them? The Son of God, one like the Son of God. You can go through the fire. And I believe that they literally went through the fire to be God's illustration. I've got you no matter how intense it seems to you. He's asking the question here. Who can go through the fire? You can, if you're like this. Now, verses 15 and 16, did they remind you of any psalm? Pardon? Amen, sister. Chapter Psalm 15. It's a big one, isn't it? David asked a simple question. Who can abide in your holy hill, in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? Who can live with you, God? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend. Somebody starts bad mouthing my friend, I'm not going to take it. Oh, is that right? He doesn't do that. In whose eyes are reprobate is despised. One of the things I hate about modern entertainment, movies especially, is so oftentimes the hero is a reprobate. We start rooting for a guy but cheating on his wife and lying to the police and doing all kinds of things because he's got a noble goal in mind, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised. But who honors those who fear Yahweh, he swears to his own hurt and doesn't change. He does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. Who can endure this fire that's coming? David didn't ever see a fire of this nature. Who can endure the invasion of a guy that wants to cut us all down and throw us in the fire? The one who walks right, who walks righteously. You see there, verse 15, who speaks with sincerity, who rejects unjust gain. That guy can make it through the fire that I'm about to bring. Then he says, really beautiful, verse 17, your eyes will see the king in his beauty. Whose eyes would see the king in its beauty? He says, your eyes. Pardon? Yeah, good answer, Linda. Just like Abraham rejoiced to see my day and he saw it and was glad. Just like Abraham was looking for a city whose foundation and was God. Just like that, these people could see the king. Just like, I'm going to try to say this very carefully. Just like you can see the cross. Now, to us, the cross is a thing of the past. But we weren't there. I've never put my foot on that soil. Some people have. I think Mary and Michael have been close to Jerusalem, if not in it exactly, but places where Paul put his feet. I've never even been close to Jerusalem. And yet I see the cross in my mind. I see the cross in my heart. It's as real to me as if I'd been there when they did it. And so though these people don't see the king, but they do. You take my meaning? They know in their heart that this is an absolute truth. You will see the king in his beauty. They will behold a far distant land. Your heart will meditate on terror. Where is he who accounts? Where is he who waits? Where is he who counts the towers? Where is all this tower counting and weighing out of things? And that could be talking about the privations of life. It could be talking about which buildings do we need to tear down so we can fortify the wall. We've seen some of that in Isaiah. They're not there anymore. You will no longer see a fierce people, verse 19. A people of unintelligible speech. Remember that? He will speak to them through in tongues. Remember? He will speak back in what chapter was that where we saw? Pardon? No, I'm asking where it was that he said, since you won't listen to me, I'm going to talk to you through people whose language you don't understand. A little here, a little there.
Oh,
pardon? Is that in 28? Okay. We're.
No, it's at the bottom of the page. it's 20. Yeah, it is 28:13.
So the word of 13. So the word of Yahweh to them will be order on order, line on line, a little here, a little there, that they may stumble and go backward and be broken. He's talking about how the people taken into captivity would understand their captors. They wouldn't. I took a trip to Germany one time with my brother-in-law. I had studied German in high school, but I didn't understand what people were saying until gradually I did. Okay? So right now, at the crack of a whip, you're going to learn what I'm saying. But he says here, when you see the king, you will no longer see a fierce people, a people of unintelligible speech, which no one comprehends, or stammering tongue, which no one understands. Look upon Zion, the city of our appointed peace. Your eyes shall see Jerusalem, an undisturbed habitation, a tent which shall not be folded. Its stakes will never be pulled up, nor any of its cords torn apart. What's he talking about? A permanent Jerusalem, right? The one they're in is about to be torn down. The one Jesus lived in was about to be torn down. He said, you see these mighty stones? Days coming when not one stone will be left upon another, which will not be torn down. And they said, when? He said, in this generation. That Jerusalem is torn down. But you're going to see one that won't be disturbed. Won't. Now, they could see it in their heart. They could see it with expectation. The hair was John who saw it in the vision, didn't he? He saw it in a vision and knew it was about to happen. Yeah, soon and very soon. Both ends of the book of Revelation, the time is near, the time is at hand. He was about to see that new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven so that God could dwell with his people. And it would never be pulled up. Verse 21. But there the majestic one, Yahweh, shall be for us a place of rivers and wide canals. So it's never going to be torn down, never going to be blown away, never going to be moved. And God himself will be rivers and wide canals. What picture do you have right there? Pardon?
Thinking of Revelation.
Eden.
I'm thinking of Revelation.
And yeah.
The rivers.
Okay.
The royal river. Garden.
You know what I'm thinking? A moat. A swath of water that nobody could cross to get to them. That's what I'm thinking. Let me see. A place of rivers, wide canals on which no boat with oars shall go, on which no mighty ships shall pass. For Yahweh is our judge, our lawgiver, our king. He'll save us. That this was a protection. Now, in Zechariah 2, when the young man was about to go out and remeasure the walls of New Jerusalem, God said, tell him, don't bother. Jerusalem is going to be so filled with men and people that I'll be a wall of fire around them. A physical wall could not contain the expanse that was going to take place. I'll be a wall of fire around them. I see here, I will be their protective moat, that which keeps the people out. I think that's the picture. Though I like what you're saying, I know that Ezekiel pictures a river coming, a trickle coming from the altar and becoming an ever-expanding river until it empties into the Dead Sea and makes it a fishing industry, brings it to life, okay? So I know that there's the water of life, like in Revelation, the water of life. I know that. And when we get to Isaiah 53, he'll talk about, come make a covenant with me, and I'll give you more than water. I'll give you wine and milk without cost. And so I know he talked about water as this life-giving thing. I think here he's using it as a protective barrier around my people. I may be wrong. He says in 23, your tackle hangs slack. It cannot hold the base of its mast firmly, nor spread out the sail. Then the prey of an abundant spoil will be divided. The lame will take the plunder, and no resident will say, I'm sick. The people who dwell there will be forgiven iniquity. So I get a picture of a well-protected city of God. Won't be assailed anymore by the likes of the Assyrian or anybody, but he himself would be their protection. 25:2, he'll be their judge. He'll be their lawgiver. He'll be their king. He'll save us. We'll be rescued by God. Now, he's saying that, and I repeat myself, but he's saying that in the face of this tidal wave of the flood or this massive wall of fire, whichever picture you want to use, the approach of the Assyrian army and with it, the national time of darkness. All right, that's enough for me for tonight. Got any thoughts? And everybody looks up at the clock and sees that I ended 2 minutes early. Yes, Linda, go ahead.
Seer saw that if there's a time of fireballs, and this is near this area, he said,
"What area?"
Vision, like the vision. Somebody handed him a baby, and then a square went over him. But he couldn't see what was going on. So that's a time of disaster like this. In that sort of time, if we're righteous, we could get protection.
We don't need an external seer to know that. Because we're promised right here that God would be a moat that keeps the enemy out. We're promised that he would be a wall of fire around us. We're promised that he'd be our protection. So that's good enough for me right there. Any other thoughts? Well, yeah, there's no question about this was not applying to today, but it was applied to the cessation of Israel's national darkness. The king would come. The king would reign. The king would protect and deliver. Now, we come to that same kingdom that he's talking about here. And so we come into the same protection. Okay? All right. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your participation.